Support for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation and Stonyfield Farm.
From the Jennifer and Ted Stanley Studios in Somerville, Massachusetts, this is Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. Today, a special report on the once and future source of power, the atom. We begin 100 years ago, when at the age of 26, Albert Einstein came up with a radical notion that would forever change our concepts of space, time, and the link between mass and energy.
Furthermore, the equation E is equal mc squared, in which energy is put equal to mass multiplied with the square of the velocity of light, showed that very small amount of mass may be converted into a very large amount of energy, and vice versa.
Einstein's theory of relativity told us that great forces could be unleashed if large atoms were split, and even greater energies freed if small ones could be fused together. Large atoms like uranium naturally fall apart, decaying with radiation, so it didn't take scientists long to figure out how to ignite that process and explode a bomb or run a power plant. But it's much harder to fuse atoms together in the continuous way the sun turns hydrogen into helium. Bruce Gellerman has our report on the people who are trying to do just that.
It's easy to see why scientists say fusion is the energy source of the future. The primary fuel is a form of hydrogen called deuterium. And scientist Michael Swartz says there are oceans of it.
In every cubic mile of seawater is enough deuterium to produce equal energy to all of the Earth's reserves. So if we could tap it, we would essentially have a limitless form of energy for the planet.
Not only that, fusion is virtually non-polluting. There are no greenhouse gases, and the waste product is helium, the stuff in toy balloons.
What it offers is a chance to power the United States with an economy that does not produce pollution.
Sound too good to be true? Well, that's the promise physicists have been making since they began working on fusion in the 1950s. And they have come up with two very different visions of fusion's future. One hot, one cold. We'll have more about cold fusion later, but first, Earl Marmor, a senior scientist at MIT, unlocks a door mainstream physicists say is the surest route to fusion energy.
So this is our control room.
Inside Marmar's laboratory, researchers huddle over banks of computers. There are video monitors everywhere.
And this is where the scientists, the students, and the engineers hang out when we're actually operating the experiment, which we are today. Today is a run day.
This lab looks and sounds like the control room at a lunar space launch.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
But physicists here are aiming higher than the moon.
3, 2, 1.
They want to create the power of the stars.
Entering pulse.
30 times a day, 4 days a week, Earl Marmor and his team of scientists send a pulse of electric current through the experimental fusion reactor they call Alcator C-Mod. And for a few brief moments, they create energies found only in the stars.
Entering recool.
So that's it.
That's it. Yeah, that was a successful shot. We had a nice 2-second pulse, and now we're going to study what happened on that pulse.
So you went to 60 million degrees in there?
Approximately, yeah. Give or take a factor of 2, yeah.
The 100-ton Alcator C-Mod experimental fusion reactor is exciting science, as big and as expensive as it gets on the MIT campus. Alcator is a fourth-generation tokamak design. The name is a Russian acronym describing the shape. Tokamaks look like giant stainless steel donuts. There are about 20 in the world. This one here at MIT is the most advanced.
So can you show me the machine?
Well, actually, it's locked up because when we're operating, we don't allow people to go out there and look at it. It's about, 50 yards in that direction through those doors and then through another big 5-foot-thick concrete door.
The concrete door protects workers in the control room from getting zapped by high-energy neutrons produced when Alcator C is up and running. But compared to fission reactors, which use uranium, fusion reactors like Alcator are safer. It produces 1/1,000,000th of the radioactive waste, and there's no chance of a meltdown.
Can't happen. No. There's so little fuel at any one time in these devices that uncontrolled reaction is not possible. It's so hard to make fusion happen, you don't have to worry about that.
The reason it's so hard to make fusion happen is easy to understand. Take two toy magnets and try to get the like poles to stick together. You can't, because like charges repel. It's the same thing with fusion. The nuclei of deuterium fuel are positively charged, and getting them to fuse requires huge amounts of energy. In the center of stars, gravity does the job. On Earth, physicists reproduce a star's gravity by surrounding their tokamak donuts with powerful magnets. Alcator C mod has three of them. The force field squeezes the deuterium atoms tighter and tighter until the electrons are torn away, leaving the nuclei to zip around the donut at 1,000 miles a second, colliding and fusing and creating temperatures in the hundreds of millions of degrees. How do you get your data? Why don't your instruments melt?
Well, the instruments aren't inside the plasma. They're outside. So.
Something's got to be sensing it.
Yeah, that's visible light that's coming out of the plasma. And so it comes through a window and then goes into a TV camera. I mean, a fancy TV camera, but it's a TV camera.
The trick is controlling the turbulent fuel in the reactor, keeping the nuclear particles away from the walls of the donut where they rapidly cool. The ultimate and so far elusive goal, says Earl Marmer, is a sustained reaction, one that produces more energy than it takes to trigger it.
Right now, tokamaks generally run in a pulsed mode, whereas, for example, for us, it's a few seconds. Some of the long, bigger machines can run for tens of seconds. But in the end, we want a reactor to be running steady state.
That's a thermonuclear reaction that, once ignited, runs on its own. In the summer of 2005, after more than a decade of heated negotiations, the United States, the EU, France, Russia, South Korea, China, and Japan decided the path to a steady-state reactor would be ITER. It's an acronym for the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. ITER is designed to demonstrate the technical and scientific feasibility of fusion based upon the tokamak design. Construction is set for 2006, and when it's finished, ITER is expected to produce 400 megawatts of fusion energy for more than 6 minutes. That's twice as much energy as it needs to jumpstart the reaction, and 25 times as much energy as today's most powerful tokamak. Ray Orbach, director of the U.S. Energy Department's Office of Science, was at the Moscow press conference when it was announced that ITER would be built in the south of France.
The excitement that we all feel is that's the design goal. But there's every possibility that we would get four times that amount by, let's say, the end of the operating period, say 10 years after operations began. If we can do that, we're within shouting distance of what a commercial power plant would require.
Orbach says faced with the threat of global warming produced by burning fossil fuels and the ever-rising demand for oil, the future of the planet depends on ITER's success. But he admits it's a gamble.
Remember, this is a burning plasma that has never been constructed before, and it's a challenge.
In time and with enough money, a fusion reactor is technologically feasible. But will it ever make financial sense?
I'm quite confident that we will have fusion energy, more energy out than we put in.
Physicist Richard Garwin is IBM Fellow Emeritus at the Watson Research Center and winner of the nation's highest science award.
Whether that will be economical in comparison with other sources of energy is another question. That's a very big question.
In the mid-1990s, Congress raised the same question and didn't like the answers it was getting from physicists. Despite major advances in understanding the complexity of fusion, lawmakers were frustrated by the slow progress physicists were making. The Clinton administration had pulled out of the ITER project, drastically cut funding for tokamak research, and then went looking for alternative methods to achieving fusion. No idea was deemed too far out. Not even Jay Kestner's.
About 10 years ago, I got interested in a new approach to fusion, different from the mainstream.
Jay Kestner, a senior scientist at MIT, calls himself one of the kooks in the plasma fusion field. Kestner came up with a radical design for a fusion reactor, finding inspiration in the heavens. This thing looks like a flying saucer.
Yeah, before we put the floor here, it actually looked like the lunar landing module.
Jay Kestner stands next to what he calls his levitating dipole experiment. 10 feet high and 18 wide, the device looks like a giant squished stainless steel pumpkin. Actually, the LDX is modeled after the planet Jupiter. Why Jupiter? Well, in the 1980s, astrophysicists made a surprising discovery. A flyby voyage of Jupiter revealed its magnetic field controlled a huge, dense plasma, nearly perfect for fusion. Kestner is trying to duplicate the feat, but in order to pull it off, he had to use a magician's trick, levitation. Suspended inside the LDX vacuum chamber is a half-ton magnet.
So it's like taking a planet and making a big hole in the middle so that the magnetic field lines don't hit the planet. And that is exactly why we want to have a magnet that has a hole in the middle that looks like a bagel that's sitting there free in space. And you want it to be sitting floating freely because supports will scrape off the plasma.
And that would prevent fusion. At $6 million, the LDX is the cheapest and simplest fusion device yet conceived, and potentially it could operate more efficiently at lower temperatures than the far more expensive and complex tokamaks. Sustaining a steady-state fusion reaction would be a technological tour de force, but sustaining a steady flow of research funds has proven even more difficult. 95% of the research money comes from the federal government, and Mikolas Porkolab, director of MIT's Plasma Science and Fusion Center, says the half-life of Washington's interest in fusion is short.
If he had gotten the money 30 years ago, what we asked for, to develop fusion, then we would probably have it now working. But we never got the money. We got one-third. You can't achieve fusion if you don't give the funding to build the devices that we need.
Scientists say their goal is a commercial fusion device by 2050. But in the past, their predictions have been overly optimistic, and the goal line keeps moving. In the 1950s, physicists predicted they'd have a fusion reactor by 1970. Then it was 1990. Leading critics to quip, there's a new constant in physics, fusion, in 20 years. Robert Park writes a column for the American Physical Society dedicated to debunking scientific claims.
The joke is that fusion is the energy source of the future and always will be.
And one way forward may involve going back to the future. In just a moment, Bruce Gellerman continues our report on fusion with an update on the technology that first thrilled and then chilled the scientific community back in the 1980s, cold fusion. Stay tuned to Living on Earth.